Like any government program, once you start it, it's really hard to stop.
May it please the court, I'm Chris Colson representing Mr. Turner. There was no serious potential for conflict in Mr. Turner's case because both Womack and Mr. Turner steadfastly refused to cooperate with the government. Without cooperation by one or the other, there was no testimony by one against the other was not going to happen. Thus, the only chance that for one testimony by one by Mr. Turner against Womack or the other way was the chance that one jointly represented co-defendant would change their mind and choose to cooperate against the other. But that's the same chance inherent in any joint representation. There must be much more than this inherent tension in joint representation to find a serious potential for conflict that's required by Wheat.
Didn't Mr. Barris have an obligation to look out for the best interests of each of these individuals? So at that moment in time, when he stood before the district court judge, he had one convicted defendant who definitely had the ability to testify against Mr. Turner, that's Mr. Womack, of course, and another who could see the writing on the wall, so to speak, because the conviction had come down with the other defendants in his case. So wouldn't he have an obligation to inform each of the defendants that it would be in their best interest to cooperate with the government? Inherently making a conflict.
Your Honor, the discussion with both defendants that as to their interest in cooperating with the government must be done even before, in all joint representations, even before the representation is undertaken under Professional Rule of Conduct 1.7.
But the government in this case could have put a subpoena on Mr. Womack, immunized him to testify against Mr. Turner, and the cooperation agreement, whether he wanted to or not, would result in the conflict at a potential trial, right?
Yes, Your Honor. These events could have happened, but that's the dog that didn't bark in this case. Even today, there's no argument that the government sought Mr. Womack's testimony against Mr. Turner. That argument was not made in the government's brief to the district court, not made in the transcript of the district court's disqualification hearing, nor in the briefing to this court.
But does that matter that the government makes the initiative if the government has the ability to throw the subpoena on him and immunize him, or if Mr. Barris himself approaches the government to say, it's in my client's best interest to it's in client A, Womack's best interest, to reduce his sentence by providing information against Mr. Turner, who is his supplier. And it's in my supplier client's best interest to provide information to enhance Mr. Womack's sentence. And so they automatically at that moment in time are in conflict, aren't they?
I think I heard a couple different points in Your Honor's question. I'd like to first address the best interest point. I'm not sure we can say here that it's definitely in the best interest of either one of them to cooperate with the government. That's a decision that the clients must have discussed with their attorney before the representation was undertaken. If the clients are not interested in that, the approach of the government seeking cooperation doesn't automatically create an insurmountable conflict.
So in your opinion, then, we need to have the government approaching Mr. Barris's client first and saying, we want you to testify, which there is some evidence that there was at least one AUSA who had approached the government to say he was interested in having Mr. Turner proffer, right?
Yes. As to Mr. Turner, the government's briefing initiating the disqualification hearing indicates an interest in Mr. Turner, and also the government approached the attorney from July, who was representing Mr. Turner from July 28th until the August 9th disqualification hearing. So that right around the time of the disqualification hearing, there was some indication of interest.
And doesn't that create a real conflict then at that moment?
No, Your Honor, I don't think it does. The mere assertion by the government of interest in cooperating with one or the other, that I think would be a very broad and dangerous rule. That would allow the government to disqualify.
The practical effect would be that no lawyer could ever represent more than one person in any case.
Yes, that's
a practical effect, because the prosecutor always wants everybody to testify against everybody else. In fact, the prosecutor would actually like them all to plead guilty and accept the statutory maximum sentence.
That's effectively a per se rule, and we know that there is no per se rule in this situation. In fact, the presumption
exactly
is
under
opposite.
Exactly, and in fact, this court in the Rodriguez 1 case explicitly discussed the presumption not being on the defendant, neither the persuasion or production burden is on defendant in this under the Wheat regime. Other factors indicating how low the probability of this conflict arising include the fact that there were 7 other cooperating co-defendants from this conspiracy indictment that had agreed with the government to testify when called. And 3 of these 7 cooperating co-defendants had in fact testified against Womack, resulting in Womack's conviction. As of the disqualification hearing, these same 3 cooperating co-defendants were scheduled to testify against Mr. Turner as well.
But Mr. Womack was the only one who was supplied directly by Mr. Turner, right?
No, Your Honor. There were, as to evidence of direct drug sales, there were in fact several other, Kareem Hamilton, who agreed to cooperate with the government, Watts, who had agreed to cooperate with the government, and Huntley, who had agreed to cooperate with the government, all of them who had actually testified against Womack, all had direct supply testimony about Turner to offer, from Turner to offer. So there's actually nothing special about about direct drug sales in this case. Hamilton and Watts, 2 cooperating co-defendants, could in fact testify to direct drug transactions with both Womack and Mr. Turner.
Counsel, what effect do you think the waiver of conflict should have in this case? We know from Wheat that it can't be dispositive. So what concrete effect does or should it have?
The concrete effect that waiver by both clients here should have is to eliminate concerns that one or both of them didn't understand their rights or didn't understand the joint representation. Because the district court stated that
anybody has ever said they didn't understand. And indeed, the whole dispute here was the clients understood very well. They were trying to cooperate and resist the incentive to flip. In the game of prisoner's dilemma, cooperation is the solution. The prosecutor doesn't want the defendants to cooperate. Now that I wouldn't think that much is in any doubt. So back to the concrete question, what concrete effect does a waiver have? We can't obviously disagree with Wheat. Neither one would think. But Wheat didn't suggest that a waiver would have no effect. I'm just trying to figure out where in between something and nothing is there. Where are we?
When both clients have waived, Wheat requires that a serious potential for conflict be a showing be made of a serious potential for conflict. Your Honor, has
thank you, Mr. Coulson.
Reserve her button.
Mr. Carr. Bring the podium up if you want. Well, once it starts off, you'll have to make sure it stops. Please don't adjust the microphone. Do not touch the microphone.
Your Honor, first of all, start with the proposition which the court did, that it retained the inherent authority to make a determination as to the disqualification of an attorney in light of the fact that there was multiple representation. This is something that is not unreasonable for any prosecutor to bring to the court's attention when there's an attorney representing two people. It's not unusual for the court on its own to make that determination. So we start with the proposition that a court's making an inquiry, which is what the document was entitled, as to whether or not there's...
I think from the Supreme Court's decisions in cases like Wheat and Gonzalez-Lopez that it should be extraordinarily unusual for a court to interfere with the defendant's choice of his lawyer. Gonzalez-Lopez could hardly have been clearer that that kind of interference, even if there's more than one lawyer, is presumptively, and except in the rarest case, a violation of the Sixth Amendment. Well, the problem I have with your argument is that it's an argument that applies equally well in every single criminal case. So instead of having a rule, the defendant gets his lawyer unless there's some powerful reason, we would have the rule, in any criminal case, no lawyer can represent more than one defendant, period.
And we're not advocating that.
You are advocating that. You're advocating that by saying that any time the prosecutor says, I would like to explore with one defendant the possibility of flipping, that defendant cannot be jointly represented with any other defendant. Well,
I'm not suggesting that, and that's not
your argument.
And that's not what the court did here.
That's exactly what the court did.
It is precisely what the court did.
That was the entire rationale for the decision.
Respectfully, I think...
I could understand the argument that if one of the defendants has in fact flipped and is going to testify for the prosecution, then the lawyer is disqualified, is going to have to step out from one of them because he can't cross-examine his own client at trial. That I understand. But the argument, the prosecutor would like to talk to one client, therefore this lawyer can't represent both, is precisely gives the prosecutor a veto power over joint representation.
And I do admit that that's what the prosecutor said, but I don't think that the court made the determination. I think the prosecutor's...
It's what your brief says.
The prosecutor's approach... there's a potential that there would be a conflict because some other prosecutor wanted to approach somebody is lame, as the court indicates. But what the court did, and I guess, first of all, we'll look at Gonzalez-Lopez. In Gonzalez-Lopez, so there's no misunderstanding, the government conceded that there was a conflict there. We conceded that there were, or that the court was in, that the court had erred in... So there is a major difference there. What that decision involved was whether or not this was a structural error, which the court ultimately found it was. And it specifically suggested that that it had nothing whatever to do
Let me ask my question a different way. Is the position you're taking here reconcilable with what this court said in Rodriguez? I notice your brief doesn't discuss Rodriguez.
We didn't discuss Rodriguez, Your Honor, and I think that it is reconcilable if you take into consideration a district court who still under Wheat had the authority and the ability to make a determination.
That's what the state court did in Rodriguez, and we held that it was an unreasonable application of federal law.
But in this case, we have a district court that sat through two trials, so it's not just an instance where a district court is on its own listening to a prosecutor and saying that because there's multiple representation, I'm going to throw you off. This court sat through two trials and recognized the representation that was involved a person who was the source, that's Turner, of Womack, and inquired of the defense attorney, what do you do if this conflict arises? The court at that point didn't say, you're out. And that's not, that is not saying that...
Counsel,
that
I don't understand how this reconciles this position with Rodriguez. In Rodriguez, the prosecutor said, not simply we're going to talk to witness, potential witness X. The prosecutor said, we're going to call witness X. And therefore, there's a conflict. And the state court disqualified the lawyer at that point. Prosecutor never called X as a witness. Mm-hmm. We said disqualifying somebody who, because of a supposed conflict with somebody the prosecutor never called, was an unreasonable application of federal law. This the argument here seems to me on beyond Rodriguez. It's not the prosecutor's representation, we're going to call this person. Prosecutor's representation, we'd like to talk to this person about the possibility of calling him, is enough to disqualify someone.
And I think what happened here, if I could, I think what happened here is the court, under Rule 44, obviously listened to the prosecutor, but then made an independent inquiry.
Dealing with the Rodriguez case, I keep asking about how this can be reconciled with Rodriguez, and you keep telling me what the facts of this case are, but it doesn't help me reconcile your position with Rodriguez.
I think that there is a difference in Rodriguez when we're talking about an issue where the conflict involves a witness that wasn't called, and there's representations that that's going to be, and a situation, it doesn't just have to be a witness that's going to be called and the conflict that occurs because of a potential cross-examination issue. It can be divided loyalties. For instance, Your Honor pointed out...
That was the argument in Rodriguez.
As Your Honor...
and was rejected by this court.
Well, if I may finish, I think what Your Honor is pointing out and what the Supreme Court decided was that the court, that a conflict can arise in a variety of circumstances. For instance, not even mentioned in any of these briefs is the fact that Womack, who is set for sentencing, may very well be in a situation where in a 3B1.2, he might have a minor role in the offense. So separate and apart from cross-examination issue where you're cross-examining your client, Womack may have a minor role in the proceedings and be entitled to a couple-point reduction or maybe even a four-point reduction. And to do that, he would have to make the determination as to whether or not he told about Turner's role. So I do think that there is a difference. The court, when it's heard in this case from Roosevelt, in this case when the court has been through and listened to two different trials and knows that Turner himself was the source of Womack, and not only the source of Womack, but sources of other people and may have had those kinds of roles, that is something the court can take into consideration. Gonzalez-Lopez left to the court the decision as to whether or not a conflict existed or could exist in light of that. And the issue here is whether or not the court abused its discretion. And I would think that in making...
Let me ask you the same question I asked Mr. Coulson.
Okay.
What concrete effect does the waiver of conflict have?
I think it's a case-by-case basis. I don't think that anybody can stand up here and tell you that a waiver automatically...
You must be doing the application of some principle to the facts of each case. We're not making up different principles in each case. So what principle is it that we would be applying to the facts of each case?
If there is a knowing and voluntary waiver, it would seem to me that a Sixth Amendment right to counsel of your choice would be something that should be protected. The issue
Does
is what...
Does that apply to actual conflicts, for
I don't
example?
Think that it matters whether it's actual or a potential conflict. I think that the court can make the determination based upon potential conflict and can make that determination based upon things like the fact that while you may have the best advice in the history of the world from some attorney about a conflict and you got a waiver, that a 2255 may be on the way, saying that it was based upon a subsequent attorney saying that counsel's advice was tainted.
So you're saying an actual conflict is or is not waivable? You seem to be arguing both sides.
I think an actual conflict can be waivable. I think a potential conflict can be waivable. And I'll give you an example. Say, for instance, in a conspiracy, conspirators don't have to know each and every person involved in the conspiracy. You've got a person that's just an offloader of a truck. And an attorney represents him, and then he also attempts to represent somebody who's a financier. In those instances, I think it would be waivable because there's not a likelihood that what it is that one's going to say will in any way affect that interest. It's different if you have people that are, which this court, in the exercise of its discretion, was aware of because of the trials, where you have people that are directly involved together, one being the source of the other, and it's not whether the prosecutor brought to the attention of some defense attorney the likelihood that, you know, maybe you could cooperate. Every defense attorney that walks into federal court not only knows that leniency is an issue, but would advise his client before he even talked to the prosecutor what the judge is likely to do, what the prosecutor is likely to do, and what the implications of cooperation are. So if you have all that going on, I don't think it's unreasonable at all for the court to take into consideration the fact that the advice that you may be giving to both of your clients at that point would be subject to somebody in a subsequent hearing on 2255 questioning it because of the divided loyalties.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Anything further, Mr. Coulson? All right. Well, Mr. Coulson, we appreciate your willingness and that of your law firm to accept the appointment in this case and the assistance you've been to the court as well as your client. The case is taken under advisement, and the court will be in recess until tomorrow.